The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. The fight over your dinner table. No, it's not between you and perhaps your children or your other relatives. It's the fight between grocery stores to deliver the food that would actually end up on your table. Here to tell us more about the grocery store wars is Scott Mushkin, senior retail and staples analyst for Wolf Research. Scott, always a pleasure. Give us your thoughts on the cost that is being borne by companies like Amazon to actually get the food and products to the table of their consumers and customers, because that's not cheap. They say it's free if you're a Prime customer, but somehow, somewhere, someone's paying for it.
Yeah, it's a great point, Pim, and thanks again for having me on. Hi, Lisa. So, yeah, I mean, I think the challenge with consumables, and particularly those everyday reorderable items like a toothbrush or toothpaste, Tide, deodorant, I mean, we as consumers would like them delivered to our house. Our research shows the challenge is it's not that economical to get us it, to get us those products. And so I think there's this push and pull in trying to understand how the economics will work, what the model will be like as we go forward over the next 5 to 10 years. And Amazon's, you know, obviously bought Whole Foods. It's in what we consider the driver's seat of trying to put an omni-channel spin on consumables, and we had just they had the announcement out of Walmart. It's going to be delivering from a lot of its stores. So the grocery wars are definitely taking place. We think they favor Amazon significantly, as they don't have they haven't built out their assets. They're in the process of doing that. And for other bricks and mortar companies, it's tough. I mean, they're having to follow Amazon, who's now setting the strategic vision for the industry.
All right. So I'm just wondering, so Amazon might have the upper hand, but they've tried to get into this industry before and failed. And this is notoriously hard, hard nut to crack as far as food delivery and replacing brick and mortar. Do you think that the stock reaction, which has been fierce with grocers like Kroger and bankruptcies of an increasing number of such companies, do you think it's overdone at this point?
You know, actually, I don't. And I think the challenge is we look to China and what Alibaba is doing with Hema. And we think the purchase of Amazon of Whole Foods is a watershed event where what we're going to see, I think, is a blend, an omni-channel blend develop. And it's a darn shame because the stores had a huge home field advantage we've talked about before, where people still buy almost all their fresh at the store. And what we're seeing is that home field advantage being surrendered to the vision of Amazon. And I think it's going to be a, like I said, an omni-channel blend, and it will incorporate some bricks and mortar stores as you've seen them by Whole Foods. But so I think they, you know, they have some of their best people working on this. We think they're going to combine Amazon Now, Amazon Fresh, and Whole Foods into one offering. But the idea is to really bring the omni-channel experience, and incorporate stores into that offering to make it a little bit more economical.
All right. So far this year, Kroger and Walmart have lost more than $30 billion in market value combined. Other grocers have also seen their shares plunge. Is there a specific company that you're looking at that has more pain to go?
So we've been pretty bullish on the U.S. economy and what's going on with the tax cuts. We think nominal growth in the U.S. is going to pick up. But that's really a short-term call, short-term relief for an industry that's under extraordinary pain and change. So our long-term vision of staples retailing, as we call it, is very negative. And the reason is we think Amazon's going to grab 20 share, up from less than 3% share right now.
Yeah.
And that 20 shares got to come from someone.
Well, right, but very negative, meaning how many bankruptcies or how much devastation with respect to specific grocers?
Well, we've already seen some announcements. We had Winn-Dixie, which was a private company but had public debt. They're doing a pre-pack bankruptcy, Tops Up in the northern part of the U.S. I think this is going to be part of what we see. One of the things that we've been thinking about a lot is content. Who has content that people may pay for? In other words, you already have one subscription to Prime, so you're paying $99 a month. And what that's going to get you is a lot. It's going to get you access to Whole Foods, Now, Fresh, obviously all the video content that Amazon has. So what other retailers are set up with content specific to them? We actually think this actually favors, they're not public companies, but we think this favors some of the smaller private supermarkets, someone like HEB down in Texas, very good grocer, a very good merchant, and probably able to charge for delivery. The other company that we like is Sprouts, Sprouts Farmers Market, 30,000 square foot store, right in, call it the best pure foods, pure play, natural and organic, fresh. So we like Sprouts. All the other companies, public and some of them are private, owned by private equity. We get really nervous because a lot of share is going to have to move, in our opinion. And when that share moves, it puts a lot of pressure. The other thing is it's just costing more to do business. So, Walmart, they're going to have 2,000 stores that have click and collect. They're going to have another, 800 stores delivering. That's all added costs. And unless you're able to charge, it's going to really hurt the economics of the business as we move forward. Same thing for Kroger.
Scott, I'm surprised that I'm talking to you. I think you're in Mississippi. I thought you'd be at the Shop Talk trade show, because that's where a lot of the Amazon and eBay, Alphabet, Facebook, and all these companies are giving presentations about the future of retail. And one of the points I was reading about earlier is that Google is integrating the retail product categories, like, from Walmart or Target, with what they describe as the universal shopping cart. They're going to share the checkout page and the online payments with a commission pricing model. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, Google's basically going to start charging some of these retailers for their search. And again, somewhat, Amazon has an advantage here. A lot of searches start right on Amazon for product. And so they have an ecosystem that includes all of this. And so if you're using Google and Google has a lot of power, they're going to start charging you as a retailer. I actually think that's an advantage to Amazon. And another reason to fear the retailers' economics, not that they're necessarily going to go away and go bankrupt, all of these guys, but the retailers' economics are going to be under pressure. And of course, we saw today with an Amazon announcement that pressure tends to roll downhill to some of these manufacturers. So manufacturers are going to be under pressure too, particularly, again, if you don't have good content, if you don't have things that people are willing to pay for.
Scott Mushkin, thank you so much for joining us. Scott Mushkin, Managing Director and Senior Staples Retail Analyst with Wolf Research, normally in New York, but today in Mississippi.
Right now, the shares of Facebook, they are lower by 5%. The company grappling with backlash over its role in spreading disinformation. Here to tell us a little bit more about the story and what the reaction in Congress might be is our own technology reporter, Sarah Friar, joining us from San Francisco. Sarah, thanks very much for being with us. Any updates in terms of the Facebook reaction to this and also reaction to the news that Alex Stamos, the chief information security officer, is set to leave the company in August?
Well, I have a story today that explains how Facebook made this into a crisis almost by the way it responded to it. Basically, by preempting the news reports with its own blog post on Friday explaining that it was suspending Cambridge Analytica, it made it seem like they had their own information on Cambridge Analytica obtaining the data. They didn't. So now Facebook has, as they're spiraling into crisis, they have to show people that they don't actually know if the reports are true on their end, so they can't take stronger action or have Mark Zuckerberg or Sheryl Sandberg speak until they have completed an internal audit. So they've really put themselves in this really difficult position that they didn't need to be in, where they're sort of trying to undo some of the weight that they gave to the reports by preempting them.
So, Sarah, is this why the shares are down so much? Because the botched response suggests a vacuum of either leadership or appropriate response thought in the C-suite? Or is it sort of a game changer now that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is getting involved, and President Trump also commenting and saying just this morning that all Americans should expect privacy of data?
I think that there's a number of factors. I think Facebook made this a big story in part by taking action before the story happened. But I do think that this is a moment in all of Facebook news where people look at the way things have worked and they're starting to say, wait, this is not good. This is not helpful for our users of these products that are so dominant around the world. So we need to start asking questions about the way it's always worked. Facebook's stance here is that this is a problem that's sort of been resolved by an update they made in 2014, that they have, they have to figure out if this is actually true, audit it. Nobody trusts them anymore. We have people calling for Zuckerberg or Sandberg to testify in front of lawmakers on both sides of the Atlantic. The FTC is now involved. This is a point where people are saying that they don't expect that Facebook will have users' best interests in heart when they go and try to solve these problems on their own and then reassure the public that they've done so.
Sarah, maybe you could just also speak to the perhaps confrontation or the constant back and forth between those people at Facebook who are more eager to look at ways to make money than those who are fighting for the protection of data and information that has been voluntarily entered into the Facebook system by users.
So Facebook is saying that the information that was accessed by Alexander Kogan, the creator of this personality app, he did it in a way that was valid per Facebook's policies at the time, which allowed people to give information not just on themselves but on their friends. So 270,000 people using the app resulted in information on 50 million people. Facebook doesn't allow that anymore, but per their policies at the time, that was routine. And what people are saying now is okay, we understand that you changed those policies, Facebook, but did you ever look into, once these third parties received data on wide swaths of people, did you ever look into whether they were doing right by it, protecting it? Of course, in this case, Alexander Kogan gave that data to Cambridge Analytica, which the users had not agreed to. And there's a big question here about, like, how does Facebook audit these relationships with third parties? And the company, I don't necessarily think it's at odds with their business model. I mean, their business model is all about making sure that the information that people give Facebook, their demographic information, their interests, their groups that they've joined, all that information can be used with marketers to target them ads. That's like the promise of the free internet, right? You get the internet for free. These companies get your data and they get to target you ads based on that data. Advertisers, I spoke to one last night. They actually want Facebook to show users that they are good with their data privacy. Advertisers don't want to be advertising on a service that users have a bad feeling about. It's not going to be good for their business.
And I would, well, you tell me, I mean, with the revelation that Alex Stamos is going to be leaving the company in August, didn't he lead a group of engineers that found out in June of 2016 that, and that was the month the Democratic National Committee announced that it had been attacked by Russian hackers. They said, yeah, there's a lot of Russian activity and that they actually had people paying for these fake accounts.
Yeah, I was speaking with the head of Newsfeed in August of that year, and he said, oh, yeah, we've been starting to look into misinformation on Facebook and the spread of it. I mean, the company was starting to see the signs. Just remember Facebook's position at that time. The company was responding to a controversy over its news curation, that it may be silencing conservative viewpoints. So the company's reaction to crises is very, very reactionary. They don't want any bad news out there. They want everyone to feel like they are this unbiased platform for anything.
Sarah Fryer, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much. And thank you for all of your fantastic reporting. Sarah Fryer is a technology reporter for Bloomberg News.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Trade tariffs and China. Here to help us understand the current situation and what is likely to unfold this week is Andrew Maeda. He is our global economy reporter for Bloomberg News. He can be followed on Twitter at @AMaeda. And he joins us from our 99.1 studios in Washington, D.C. Andrew, thanks for being with us. Maybe just bring everyone up to date on what is going on between the United States and China as it relates to trade and tariff wars.
Sure. So the U.S. administration has been investigating whether China basically disregards U.S. intellectual property and forces American companies to transfer technological know-how to the Chinese. And that investigation is nearing a close. A report has been submitted to the president, and he's considering a number of different options, including $60 billion in tariffs on Chinese products.
All right, Andrew, I was struck by a top headline today on the Bloomberg Terminal about how China is pledging not to interfere or violate intellectual property rules with any foreign companies coming to the nation, basically saying, guys, let's just work this out. We're not going to do anything bad. Please trust us. Does that work? Does that fly?
I think Larry Kudlow, who just replaced Gary Cohn, is going to say, this is positive. This is encouraging. We should work with this. We should sit down at the negotiating table where the world's two biggest economies, you know, the global recovery is actually going pretty well. Let's not mess this up. I think Peter Navarro is going to say, these guys have made promises before. They haven't lived up to them. They've been making promises since 2001, since they joined the WTO, and talk is cheap.
Well, Andrew, can you give us some specific examples of products that might be hit with these kinds of tariffs? I mean, I was looking at things like textiles, and the details there are really astounding because it, you know, really goes everything from the kind of fabrics that you might use in clothing to the kinds of products that, boy, I mean, you'd never, you know, whisk brooms, ethyl alcohol, milk and cream, olives, tuna. I mean, it is a dizzying array of products.
Yeah, my understanding is they're looking at everything from shoes, apparel, travel goods. So we're talking luggage, to, you know, higher end consumer electronics. I understand that one way USTR is looking at it is they're taking China's own economic plan, the Made in China 2025 plan, and they're looking at areas of technology that China is trying to lead in, and they're trying to target those areas for tariffs.
All right. So one thing, as we watch the headlines coming out of the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires in Argentina that's ongoing right now, there actually is a greater call for trade, free trade, and trade tariff loosening or any other restrictions being sort of released among countries other than the U.S. Can you talk a little bit about that and how much that could potentially offset talk of a trade war, tariffs, or other rhetoric that we're hearing out of the White House?
Yeah, I think that overall, actually, the situation for the global economy and trade volumes is pretty positive. For the first year in a long time, growth in trade volumes actually outpaced growth in overall output. So in other words, trade resumed being an engine of global growth. So things are actually going well. And I think that most countries in the world don't want a trade war. What's unusual about the situation is you have the U.S., which has been kind of at the vanguard of creating the current global trading system, basically trying to blow it up from within and pushing for major changes. And you have China, which for years has kind of been seen as a pariah, pushing for the status quo. So how exactly that equilibrium works out at a place like the G20, it'll be interesting to see how it works out.
Andrew, any word or any inkling of how does it work out between the United States and, let's say, Canada and Mexico in terms of exemptions on some of the already announced tariffs?
Well, Canada and Mexico have been excluded from the steel tariffs that President Trump announced earlier this month. But President Trump, as kind of is his wont, has added a condition to it. He's basically said, look, you're excluded for now. I'm recognizing that you're important security partners, but I want a good NAFTA. And if you don't give me a good NAFTA, then you know that exclusion could go away. So it's kind of creating a bit of a storm hanging over the NAFTA talks.
Well, we're going to have to wait and see what happens. But boy, Andrew, I think you're going to end up in the nitty-gritty. I mean, I've been looking at things like the commission voting on things like rubber bands from China, Sri Lanka, and Thailand, as well as digital video receivers. So it really just covers the an entire encyclopedia of products and services.
And there's an encyclopedia of agencies that have to weigh in on this, which is going to be part of the issue, getting all of them to agree on rubber bands. And
I'm going to follow. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to follow Andrew Maeda on Twitter.
I'll follow you back.
Yeah, okay. Andrew Maeda, our global economy reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us from our 99.1 studios in Washington, D.C. And, we'll have to see what happens the rest of the week. $60 billion potential hit to trade.
We do have a Federal Reserve meeting that is underway in Washington, D.C., and will conclude tomorrow, most likely with an additional rate hike. Here to talk about what we can expect and what we ought to be paying attention to is Ira Jersey, Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. Ira, let's start by taking a temperature of debt markets. What are they expecting Jay Powell to do tomorrow in his first press conference as chairman of the Federal Reserve?
Yeah, like you mentioned, Lisa, a hike is all but baked in the cake here. The shock would be if they didn't hike, actually. We're now 100% priced for a hike tomorrow. The other thing that the market's going to be looking for is, will some of the hawkish comments that Jay Powell made during the Humphrey Hawkins testimony and a number of others have hinted at, will that show up in the summary of economic projections that are also be released with the statement tomorrow? And then Jay Powell will have to kind of describe them in more detail during his press conference, because the market is now pricing for 5 hikes by the end of 2019. And I think that that's pretty interesting, because when we talked just a couple of weeks ago, the market was only pricing for 4. So we're pricing in a full other hike now over the next year and a half or so.
Ira, I'm wondering if you could bring into this conversation the global issues having to do with the reduction in quantitative easing, because European Central Bank President Mario Draghi announcing that he's going to phase out those monthly asset purchases by the end of 2018.
Yeah, so I think the ECB action is yeah, kind of realistic, but they're trying to temper that with, saying, look, we're gonna stop our asset purchases. We're gonna try to avoid a taper tantrum, and so far they kind of have. I think we had our taper tantrum for that last June. But by saying that, hey, we're still not going to hike for a very long time, I think that that's tempered the expectations of how steep the yield curve can get in Europe. And that is the one thing that could probably significantly steepen the U.S. yield curve is if European rates back up quite a lot. So you still have very low interest rates in Germany and a lot of developed Europe. And if those were to move 40, 50, 60 basis points, those would have significant knock-on effects to U.S. rates. But so far, it's been pretty orderly, at least. You've seen a little modestly higher rates, but they haven't really spiked higher like they did last June when he first suggested that that quantitative easing might be coming to an end.
Okay. Now, take that possibility of the effects of a reduction in asset purchases by the European Central Bank. And how do you factor in the risk that Shinzo Abe, Prime Minister of Japan, he's got a political scandal that he's dealing with, and that could also affect what the governor of the Bank of Japan, Kuroda, is forced to do. They may be thinking about unwinding their stimulus package.
Yeah, so I think, Japan's an interesting case, because it's been a long time since the actions domestically within Japan have really played out on a global horizon. It's certainly affected the yen and versus the euro and the dollar. It's affected, Japanese rates, obviously, keeping with the Bank of Japan saying, hey, we're going to keep our 10-year rates near zero, and we're going to buy whatever we need to do that. It's very unclear what would happen if they let their 10-year rate, say, go up from, 10, 12 basis points up to, right now it's at 4, but up to, say, 50 or 60 basis points. Would that have a knock-on effect globally? And it's less clear what the relationship of the Japanese market is to the rest of the world. And yeah. I suspect it'll be less than some people fear.
So, Ira, I want to focus on something that is happening. It's not a potential, and it's actually raising a lot of eyebrows. We've talked about this before, the gapping out spread between LIBOR and OIS. Translation, the cost of borrowing dollars has surged, even when compared with the overnight index swap rate, which is basically the Fed's rate. This is generating a lot of eyebrows being raised and questions. We've talked about it. You don't think it's banking stress. You don't think it's much to worry about. But Citigroup came out with a report that said that there are real world negative consequences from this increase in LIBOR, which really is a benchmark for trillions of dollars of assets. Do you agree?
Yeah, for sure. It's raising the borrowing costs for anyone who borrows at a floating rate in particular. This is raising the cost. So this could be raising the cost for people who have mortgages that are going to reset soon, for example. And if those reset the LIBOR, it's certainly affecting people who have credit card debt that's based on LIBOR and anyone who issues floating rate notes that are, again, LIBOR based. Now, what's interesting is that a lot of floating rate note issuance is companies that issue these floating rate notes, a lot of them swap those back into fixed. So what they do is, especially when interest rates were lower, so anyone who issued, say, a year or two ago, when interest rates were very low, they might have issued a floating rate note because it was cheap financing, because investors said, I don't want to buy fixed rate debt when Treasury yields are at 1.5%. But I'm happy to buy a floating rate note because that protects me when the Fed starts to hike. But then those companies then do an interest rate swap that floats it back in the fix. So it's probably not it's not like there's a systemic risk here, but for some borrowers, certainly it's increasing their cost of borrowing a little bit more. It's kind of like another two Fed hikes have happened for borrowers who tend to borrow against LIBOR.
Thanks very much for being with us. Ira Jersey is always an expert when it comes to interest rates. He's our chief U.S. interest rate strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.